Right, good morning. Today I am with Duncan. Morning, Chris.
Morning, Gary. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good, thank you. So we've just been chatting off air, so this is the first time that we've chatted, actually, other than a little bit of social media. So I suppose I should really say hello in a proper way. It's been great to have that little chat just to understand a little bit about yourself. So do you just want to inform the listeners of your background, if you could?
Yeah, so I suppose going right back to birth, born and raised in Edinburgh, and never wished to leave, never have left. Educated here and then kind of got into hockey as a 10-year-old. My older sister had played national age group level, so that was always a cool thing to do in my family, was to try and emulate her. So got into it from that, and then, yeah, had a really great playing career. Was very fortunate to play kind of for Scotland under 16, under 18, under 21, and then senior level. Which was just an amazing experience and something that I'll never forget. And then following that and following the realisation that those days were over for me as a relative youngster, threw myself into the coaching game with the idea of trying to kind of replicate the successes and the amazing experiences I had as a player and try and help as many people as possible do that as a coach and see where it took me. So obviously you'll know from your kind of day job that careers in hockey are not all that accessible at times. So what started as a real hobby and something I really enjoyed has transpired to become, you know, the thing that I do for a living, which is amazing and something which I wouldn't change for the world.
No, absolutely. And if the opportunity comes up, you're not going to say no, are you? There are, as you say, very few and far between these jobs. So at the moment, do you want to explain who you're coaching at the moment? So do you want to just give us a quick outline of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So my day-to-day job, I'm director of hockey at Edinburgh Academy School up in Scotland. So most days are spent here, and I'm very fortunate outside that to have work with a local club. What is now in a player coach capacity, but I'd much rather it just to be in a coach capacity. Right. Where my body really stands up to playing anymore. Inverleith Hockey Club, and I've been doing that for just as my first season there. That was the club that I started playing at when I was a youngster back as a 10-year-old. So it's actually really nice to be back there and see how the club's developed and see some friendly and familiar faces, and then also try and do my bit to help out and kind of giving the next generation the opportunity to have the successes that I did. And then outside that, in 2016, I've been the head coach of the Scotland under 16 boys side, which has just been a brilliant experience, an absolutely brilliant experience. The big learning for me is that when I was a 16-year-old, we were nowhere near as good as these kids are now. We had nowhere near the level of ability or tactical understanding or technical proficiency. So it's a really cool environment, a cool space to work in. And then just in January was made an assistant to the Scotland women's team, which has been really cool. Under a brand new coaching setup, it's been nice to kind of get my teeth into that. My knowledge of women's hockey is limited in reality, having never really worked within it other than at school level. So yes, There's been lots to learn from that perspective. But yeah, there's plenty to keep my hands full. And then on top of that, I'm also doing a PhD part-time. Oh, wow. So yeah, most people say that. Where do you find the time? Yes. Not really sure where I find it. And I think it tends to be my wife that ends up getting neglected. Pretty busy. And I would say that everything I do kind of links back into each other. So it's nice to be doing a PhD, which is in sports, and also being able to work in sports. So
absolutely. So just thinking about some of that there, I've actually got stuff written off the paper, but I'm actually going on the paper, but I'm just going to go off script a little bit. Playing wise, you started playing at 10. So what did that look like for you? So did you just go to your local club, and then how did you progress then to making your way into this international hockey player that you became? So how did that actually happen?
I suppose just kicked off going to the local club, Inverleith Hockey Club, which was pretty close to where I lived, on a Sunday morning, and just that once a week session. I can't really remember what it looks like. I remember doing an awful lot of drills. I learned to hit the ball, spent an awful lot of time on the technique of that, as was kind of the case back then. And then just really got the bug for it. And I think where I really then got into it, I moved school. Actually, the school I now work at is the school I attended in secondary school. So came here, and the opportunities to take part in sport were huge. and a lot bigger than they were where I was. So that just kind of made the number of times and the volume of training and opportunities that I had a lot higher. So it kind of all kicked on and progressed from there. I'd never had the world's greatest time as a youngster. Everyone goes through their puppy fat stage. I went through mine from the kind of ages of 10 to 14. So never really had much success as a youngster. And then luckily was told about age 14 that if I did a bit of work on my fitness, I might have a chance to do okay. So I kind of went away and did that work, and it was latterly picked for Scotland under 16 level, and then really got the bug from there. And I think so much so, I put so much focus onto hockey that I forgot about schoolwork for a little while. Right. And it's a story that I tell to all the kids here, that it's so important that you balance both. And I realise we're going off script here, but I think it's so important. When we forget, kids who are really gifted at sport and excel at sport have a great time. And people think it's a brilliant lifestyle, but it's not, because it puts so much more demands on their time as a youngster. And I think I've kind of developed a real appreciation now working in a school of just how much kids have to do and just how many people are pulling them and want a bit of their time. So I definitely felt foul of that, and had a tough time in my S5 year up here, so my Scottish Highers year, the second last year before leaving school, and didn't do so well. But I was really fortunate that sport had taught me how to manage and segregate my time. So I was able to actually kind of turn my academic life around after a pretty rocky road. So I've got a lot to kind of thank sport for. I never would have thought back then that I would have done an undergrad, a master's, and then be in a position where I'm doing a PhD, having failed a lot of my subjects. But I think sport really helped me kind of change that. So that's something I always try and get across to people.
Which is, ultimately, that's, if we talk about a little bit about Great Britain hockey and the end in mind, I suppose, well, that's some of that, isn't it? That the sport is educating them, not just around hockey, but all the other bits. So you've managed to self-organise in some respects and pull yourself through that.
Yeah.
You've started to make the right decisions. Sorry.
Totally. And I think, you know, it's funny you say that. I had a conversation with a parent this morning just on the phone about something. And we were talking about, you know, the opportunity to play sport and play in teams is not just about competing in sport. It's also about kind of developing resilience, opportunity to make relationships in a different setting, to have different types of friends and groups. And it's just so all encompassing. And I think the more learning that we can get through to people about, you know, being better people, being better kids, being better children, the more we're going to do for society moving forward. And I think that's why sport can be such a positive medium to do this through.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So along that journey there, who do you think influenced you the most? Was there a specific coach or teacher that influenced you within the sport the most, that left the most powerful impact, I suppose, would be the word?
Yeah, I think we always, and you'll be the same, and any player will look back on individuals who really devoted time to you and gave you opportunities and kind of put in and went that extra mile. There was a man who was my teacher who only came to the school for about 18 months, maybe in 2 years. James Pillinger is his name. Okay. He now works at a local school to us. And I'll be embarrassed if he ever hears this, but yeah, he left a really profound impact on me. I really changed the way that I thought about the game and approached sport as an entity, rather than thinking of just as a sport, but kind of really changing my mindset about how to appreciate. And I think that I don't only have him to thank in terms of my sporting success, or probably kind of getting my academic and my life back on track after having some tough times. So he's been great, and I've been so fortunate to work with some brilliant coaches. And I think that's what's really helped me mold myself into a coach, is just working with great people and learning and taking up bits and bobs that you like from them that you can then add into your things. You know, guys like Graham Moody, who's the Scotland 21 men's coach, and he's the assistant to the senior men, was my club coach at Edinburgh University. And again, just the kind of way he thinks about the game and the things he sees and the detail that he goes into. And that was brilliant to work with him for 3 or 4 years. I just learned so much. I found myself going home from training, not just writing up my own thoughts of my own performance, but then writing up the kind of stuff we did and why. and started kind of preparing myself for the coaching life beforehand by taking notes. And I thought it was a bit weird at the time. But then I read back and watched somebody with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer recently who said the same thing, that he spent his time writing up what he had done and what Sir Alex Ferguson had done and how much he'd learned from that. So I think it's really important
him,
for people.
Has it, at the moment? So,
He's done all right. As a Liverpool fan, I wasn't too disappointed to see them lose on Sunday. But
me too. As a Liverpool fan, I wasn't too fussed either, really. But it's been. I've listened and read a few things around him as well, and the stuff that he was writing up was quite powerful, I thought. So if you were doing that as well, that's a very powerful thing to do. So just shows that what type of individual you are as well, which is. It's great, you know, you were on task and you were ready to challenge yourself and challenge others, which is probably what makes you such a good coach in some respects. It's good. Was there any others along that journey that sort of inspired you?
You know, it's funny you're actually asking this question. It's not something I've ever really thought about, Gary.
No.
And I wonder if others have the same thing. You obviously have a lot of people to thank, but...
It's a tough one. Like if I think about it, no one's really asked me it either. But I look back and I think probably my PE teacher was probably the person that inspired me the most. And you've obviously mentioned that the coaches along the way have done some really good stuff. But there's nothing really that sticks out. It's just helped shape me into who I am, which is probably something similar to you. It's just people you work with, stuff like that. They do little bits and that helps you shape where. You're going.
I mean, it is interesting. I mean, you think back to just it's the little things that happen. It's almost the people that give you a hard time are the people you have the most thanks for, because anyone who is willing to kind of put their head above the parapet and call you out on something, I think a lot of people look at it as a negative. But if you turn it into a positive and think, actually, this person is telling me this for a reason and they're trying to help me out, I think that happened a lot with me when I was younger. And I wonder if many people who had the same experience thought of it as a negative, but kind of tried my best to turn it into a positive and work out why they were saying these things to me and then try and use them. So many people.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. And, I've spoke to a couple of people around bits and pieces in the past, but some children, I can imagine that some children that you've coached, some people that you've taught have probably influenced you more than, other coaches that you've worked with, you know, the way that children react to you has probably helped, again, shape who you are. And that's just my own thoughts. I'm not entirely sure whether it's correct for you, but you know.
No, I would say so. I think I really only learned to coach when I started working with certain individuals. I'm almost fortunate to have worked with some really gifted and able individuals and players. And that's probably taught me how to coach and made me think about how I can help these individuals. It was a really cool moment for me when kids that I'd coached kind of got their first opportunities to play for Scotland or got called into Great Britain squads. And you think back and say, well, actually, you taught me more than I taught you. You were always going to be good, but actually just working with you made me really have to think outside the box as to how I was going to help you. So, no, I think it's... challenging situations are a big part of how you learn as a coach. I think how you work with individuals and what they teach you, and then obviously what you take from people in the past and how you put it into action.
Definitely, for sure. Okay, let's talk about your coaching journey. So when did you first start coaching?
Always did the usual and kind of helped out as a youngster when I was about 16 to 18, helped out at my local club, but with no real focus point. And then when I left school, it seemed like a brilliant avenue to make some money as a student. And I think most people get into it like this. I never really had the drive or desire to work in a shop or anything like that or have a desk job. So it was nice to be able to get myself outside and do something enjoyable. And I've always said that working within hockey has never felt like work because you're really enjoying what you're doing. So that's when it really hit. And for the first couple of years, I just did my bit and took in my money, helped pay the rent as a student. But, laterally started to really, really enjoy what I was doing. There's something great about achieving as an individual and as a player when you manage to do something, but actually the process of helping someone else achieve, almost feels more rewarding.
Yeah, definitely.
Because there's so many barriers you have to jump over, and there's so many things that they have to be able to cope with, to be able to achieve. So there's something really special about that. And I think it was moments like that that made me think, you know, I really want to kind of get better at this and do well. And at that stage, you know, still had no thought. My undergraduate degree was in business management, so I had no plan to kind of go into the sporting field. It's amazing how that has developed from just being a volunteer to in a position where I could kind of call this my job.
So let's think about that. So you're a student. Who did you coach first? You know, let's have a look at that. So,
oh my word, my first coaching job was at the school that I now work at, funnily enough. I've never flaming left this place. It's making me think of it now. Left school, came back here and kind of had a kind of external coaching job, and it was with an under 13 team, under 13 mixed team at that point.
Right.
And I had no idea what I was doing. If I turned up on time, I was I was quite pleased with myself. And at that point, when they won, I thought I was doing a really good job. Yeah. And it's amazing how my psyche has changed from a pretty naive 18-year-old 10 years down the line to realising that that's definitely not the way to go. And it's definitely not what a marker of success looks like. But I'm just slowly but surely got different opportunities. And I think my biggest exposure and opportunity was probably to coach one of the regional teams.
Right.
I was an assistant coach to an under 14 regional side, and it was just so cool to see how kids changed their persona and changed their psyche when it came to this time where they really wanted to achieve, and how focused they were. And that was something which made me think, hang on, I really need to think about how I change and how I diversify what I do and how I offer with different groups and with different people. So I think that was a pretty big moment for me. And then it kind of spiraled from there. Did a lot more work with the school, got involved as much as I could. I mean, at this point, my main focus was playing, but just tried to coach, and was really fortunate to get an opportunity to coach the kind of first team here at the school as a relative youngster, and learned an awful lot from that. And then it just spiraled and spiraled. And I was really, really, it's really amazing to have been able to do this alongside playing. So, you know, my first role was really to kind of be an assistant to the Scotland under 16 setup under the coach at that time, Neil Allen. He had a really good program set up and invited me to come and be a part of it, and that was great. And I was still an active player. I don't know, Demi and I have had a couple of conversations about trying to move away from being the player and people looking at me as the player who's now the coach instead of actually the coach who was a player, and kind of changing that. So I think I was lucky at the beginning to kind of have that kind of positive affirmation of me as a player, which helped me engage the players I was coaching, but then latterly trying to change that. So those were really big moments. And then was really fortunate to pick up my job here at Edinburgh Academy at age 22, I should say, director of hockey. They took a massive risk on me. I'm not quite sure why.
Probably because you never left, as you mentioned.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was probably the cheap one to employ because I never left. Took a master with me, and then I'll be honest, that's when I really started to learn about what I was doing. And that was the stage where I then signed up to do a master's.
Yeah.
And like other coaches, I thought I knew everything about coaching. And I would have sat there saying, I know exactly what I'm doing. And I remember the first module that I did on the MSc course through Edinburgh Uni was managing the coaching process. And I had no idea what the coaching process was. And there was so many pieces of writing and reading that I did that were just like so monumental and making me realize I had absolutely no clue. And I had absolutely zero power. So that's been the best thing. And then I've just been really fortunate to kind of get lucky with my opportunities, to be honest, to become the under 16. Look back on, and although you coach different teams, it's the different things you find. So I know we touched on this before we spoke, but you know, linking to the fact I thought I knew what I was doing, I was very instructional as a young coach, very, very instructional, and never realised that I was taking away the decision-making process from my players. And it was a moment where, in my first year here at the school, we got our first team to the national final. We did pretty well. We did a good year. We had one really excellent player. It was the first time that the kids had amazed how loud it was, and the biggest thing for me was all my instructions and the orders I was barking, because I would find myself shattered after coaching a game. The orders I was barking just weren't getting heard, and the kids couldn't hear what I was saying. And I think a lot of people reflected on that and thought, "Oh, we're hard done by." And I've probably seen that as the biggest moment in my coaching, is the this utter failure we had in front of this big crowd on a really big stage. Many people just thought the other team was better. They were better, but they weren't better because they played better than I. They were better because our team had been really poorly coached. And that was something that was quite hard to admit to myself. But once I admitted it to myself, was just a really profound moment, because, you know, my players without me could never, ever make a decision. Could never pick the right time to pass, right time to carry. Wouldn't know who to mark and where. And these were things that, you know, that's not right. The players in charge of the decision.
You basically played every ball. You went there, every ball, everything. I mean, I've been there. That's a tiring place to be, isn't it? It's a very tiring place to be.
It is, and I think that so often you never realise you're doing it when you're doing it, if that makes sense. So it's unconscious incompetence, to quote that phrase. You have no idea that you don't know what you're doing. And I'd have been better playing an Xbox with a controller. That's how kind of controlling I was being. So I was doing no favours for the players. So once I learned that, that kind of plotted the route forward for me to actually learn a bit more what I was doing. And that master's course came at the right time to help.
So is that what you did? So after obviously that event there, I know it's quite hard to think now about reflections, but you reflected on it. What was... Obviously, it struck out that your players couldn't play without you and couldn't hear you. So how did you make that change? What did you... Because you can't just go from being that coach to being, you know, like completely the opposite spectrum. It's got to be a gradual change, because it's near impossible to go from one end of the spectrum to the other. So how did you make that change?
It's probably still a change that's still occurring, to be honest. And it's definitely had its ups and its downs. I read a paper which was kind of given to me on my MSc course by, Fleck. I can't remember the first name of the researcher, but it was about the kind of familial impact in youth soccer and about the relationship between coach and players and making sure that is it too close or is it too far away? And I remember reading that and thinking that was probably one of the things that kind of engaged my reflection on that game, thinking actually my players just looked for me all the time for the answer. And I was far too close to them to realise that that's what they were doing. So I remember reading that and then went on this pretty crazy journey that I'm still on, and started learning a bit more about, you know, what coaching is and the different manners of delivering. I mean, I had no idea about them. I was a drill junkie back then. And not to say I don't do drills now. I still think there is a place for drills. I know that's an unpopular opinion among some, but I still think there is a place, but we'll get on to that. But kind of went on this loose journey from, you know, everything needing to be fairly linear in terms of learning, to going so far the other way that all I did was play games and was very non-linear about things. And then realised through other conversations, usually my wife, and I've started to learn that my wife is far too often right, and I hate listening to that, especially about coaching. But realizing that actually I went far too far the other way before I found something that kind of fits me and fits what I was all about. But it's really hard. It's really hard, Gary. And I think there's people who are young coaches need a lot of help. They need a lot of help because you just don't know what you're doing. So kind of flew right onto the other side and looked a bit at the constraints-led approach and did a lot of that. Went through the kind of game sense and TGFU frameworks and employed those. And then realised that actually the learning that the players were getting wasn't even implicit. It was just, they were just playing games with no real focus. So kind of went back into that conditioned games literature and looked at that. So I've kind of been round the houses. And I would now firmly say that I sit somewhere in the middle. And I think that instead of picking a framework and going with it, which I know that a lot of people are advocates for, I tend to look at who I've got in front of me and the needs of the athletes and the needs of the group. And to kind of nick that Stephen Covey quote, you know, start with the end in mind of that group and think about what they need and then try and pick the process that's going to help them the best. So I wouldn't say that I've ever coached one way. I think it would very much depend on who am I coaching with.
Yeah.
And what's the goal and what's the outcome?
Yeah, and you're considering the player, the child, the adult, whoever that might be. You're obviously considering those and what best learning suits them. It's a tough job, isn't it? If you think about how much time you have to consider all of that, and you have to get to know, and you need to sort of start. For me, I need to make notes on that because I can't keep that mentally because I'm just rubbish at keeping that sort of information. So I'd need to make notes on them and figure out.
Time is the big thing for me.
Yeah.
You know, how much time it takes to prepare that, but also how little time you have with people.
Yeah.
And how can you make a lasting impact and engage them in a process where their learning is kind of permanent and transferable to the game that you can do in a really short space of time? I mean, it's with the best will in the world, a club coach up here will get 2.5 hours of pitch time with their athletes a week.
Mm-hmm.
And people are expecting results instantly, and that's the thing that I really wrestle with in my head is do we have to put long-term success ahead of short-term gain, or do we put short-term gain ahead of long-term success? And I still have that battle inside my head.
I've just this morning been chatting to a club actually about a similar thing. You know, they're struggling a little bit. They need to keep moving forward, but to keep moving forward, they're talking results, and then I'm not talking results. I'm talking sort of like development of players and stuff like that. So within my day job, being the relationship manager, just trying to chat to them about keeping their youngsters because that keeps them sustainable, but also keeping current players that they've got. So, you know, what does training look like? And they were solely focused on a results system. Yeah, but we need this. But I just challenge that a little bit and go results. Will keep certain people, but actually long term you need to make sure that the programs you've got in place are developing everybody. And it was really interesting when I spoke to Brett, you know, the golden thread has fun written in it, but actually for an adult it might be enjoyment. You know, it's a slightly different phrase, and I think it needs to be that enjoyment. Every adult is playing our game because they enjoy it. They're not playing it specifically to get paid £100,000 a week, are they, like a footballer? So, you know, it could be, it has to be that enjoyment.
But I think that's one of the reasons why we get so much buy-in for what is an amateur sport in our country. You get so much buy-in because people really are committed to the process. You use the word enjoyment. They enjoy being part of something. They enjoy making new friends and colleagues. They enjoy kind of going through these journeys with people. And I think that that's the big thing in terms of long-term success. And I look at that with the club I'm working with just now, Inverleith Hockey Club. They just got relegated last year into the second division. They've been a really successful club over the last kind of 20 to 30 years. But they need to rebuild and they need to change. So the first discussion we had was, right, we do not need to get promoted this year, you know? Yeah. And there's some guys saying, they're saying, but I really want to go up and play Division One. And of course they do. And that's great to have that goal. But, you know, if you can engage them in that process and say, well, OK, here's where we want to get to. Let's map out. And how we're going to make sure we make these improvements and these developments, then people then start to kind of get on board. And I think that's one of the hard things in terms of creating your environment and kind of defining your culture is there's a lot of honesty required. And you have to have quite a lot of kind of uncomfortable conversations to begin with, to say to people, you know, okay, I really appreciate that viewpoint. However, you know, we won the game 2-1 today, but we didn't play the way we wanted to play. We didn't commit to our style of play. And whilst at some levels, and I've found that more kind of going back into the senior international set at the women, that's okay at times.
Yeah.
Because at times it's all about winning. And that's fine, because when you go to European championships or whatnot, there are games you have to win. But there's flipping. And I found this has made my life a lot easier as a coach and kind of reduced the amount of stress and concern and worry I have, is that flipping my focus to being about, right, how are we going to deliver excellence here? And can we really focus on delivering the complete performance, that the result becomes an outcome of the process rather than the focus itself? And I think that's been really useful for me. And I would definitely advocate that to anyone who's kind of getting into coaching, is realizing that you can play rubbish and win 5-0, but you can also play outstanding and lose 5-0. Yeah. You know, there'll be days that that's going to happen, and you have no control of that. But what you do have control of is the performance. And a guy, there's a guy I hear a lot, Graham Dunlop, cheesy his name is, kind of a bigger name, really good player in the past with Scottish hockey and played for Britain. He always talks about control the controllables. I laughed a lot at that phrase as a youngster, but he is absolutely hit the nail on the head with it. Because you can't control the opposition. They might smash the ball in the top corner 5 times from 5 shots.
Yeah.
But if you just focus on delivering that performance, then you can't do any more. And if the result comes as part of that, delighted. If not, not the end of the world, and you move on to the next one.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you've mentioned two things there that I'm massively loving. Yeah, environment and culture. But you've got three different environments that you need to create the right environment in. You've got your club environment, which, yes, you still need to win, but you also need to develop to keep them sustainable. And because obviously you spoke there about the relegation, etc. You've got your under-16 head coach role, which is you are trying to develop long-term success for Scottish hockey, Great Britain hockey with young players. And then you've got the senior women's role, which is, you know, yes, you are long-term. You still need to develop the right environment, the right culture, but you've also got events and matches that are must-win so that you stay at a certain level and which then potentially gets you some funding, etc., etc. So how have you managed to create the right environment, the right culture within all three? I appreciate that the Scottish women's might not be down to just you because you're not the head coach there, but obviously you've been involved within that. So really interested to find out how that sort of works.
So am I.
Yeah. Sorry. It wasn't an original question we were going to discuss, but you brought it up, so I thought I'd...
Do you know, I think it's something that I constantly have to think about, and whenever I go into a session or with a different group, really rejigging my memory about what our goals are and what the vision is. I think one of the best things is if you get the process right and you get the athletes bought in, then they will define that culture for you and they will manage it and they will maintain it. And your job as the coach is you sit on the outside and you facilitate. Yeah. I think that would be the underpinning thing I would say. How we flip between it? I suppose one of the things I've done a lot since coaching international level is I loved to be in charge to begin with. I think I would say I was almost a bit of a control freak and a power freak, and definitely an organisation freak. That doesn't work at that level. It definitely doesn't work. And I think the best thing is engaging the people around you. So if you can get the people who are your assistant coaches to really start living and breathing where you want to go and what you want to do, then they will do a lot of the work on the ground for you, and it takes the heat off you and it takes the pressure off you. And I think that's where moving to an approach which is more athlete-centred than it is coach-centred makes this a bit easier. I think if I coached as a dictator like I used to do and was very coach-centred, it would be really hard to switch between these different environments. But more so, it's just reminding myself a lot before I speak to a group or give feedback or plan a session, you know, what are our end goals here? So it's not been as tough as I wanted. It's not been as tough as I thought it was going to be.
Okay.
But I think the hard thing for me is there are times that I get annoyed about something and then I have to quickly flip my mind. Actually, no, this is a different situation. I can't get annoyed because there's a difference between a 14-year-old kid getting their first opportunity to play for Scotland, where they will make loads of mistakes and quite often they will be in a position where they will pick the safe option because they want to get picked, you know? Mm. And that's something that happens a lot. They come to training days and camps and they just keep doing the safe thing. Yeah. And I say to them, how do you think you're getting on? Oh, yeah, I'm making a lot of good decisions. I'm not making many errors. I'm like, well, here's my problem with you. I want you to make more errors because we need to think about you as a long-term developer, not just someone who's going to get into this team to go and play in this international match. You know, that's not the end goal here. That's just a small process goal. And I think that's where it's a bit different when you go to a club environment because you're working with people who have jobs and have other lives. Yeah. A kid at 14, 15 commits so much of their time to hockey and to being good that you can give them a fitness program and they go away and they do it and they'll send in their reflective diaries to me on a Sunday night and I'll go through them and I'll ask them questions and they'll come back with their thoughts. Whereas someone who has another thing and it's just a hobby, comes to training to escape and have a bit of fun and have a nice time, and then goes back to work again. So that I find is quite a tough thing to deal with in terms of environment, because you can't be as direct, maybe, or you have to speak in a very different way between these two different people, notwithstanding the age, but just the situation. And then you get to the senior level, and what I've been amazed by being involved in that is just the detail, you know, having played at that level, you don't really realize. You're fairly self-centered as a player. You think about your own performance, and you go and play your game, you go to bed, you go to the meeting, that's it. The detail to actually get a team on the pitch playing the right way is so different. So that's been a really cool culture to be a part of, because the players lead it so well.
Yeah,
and the senior women's team, they are totally in charge of it, and they've got some really impressive leaders in there who do the job, which makes your job easier. So slipping into that has been great. The biggest challenge for me between the three environments and then the school environment being a fourth one is flipping between coaching males and coaching females. That's the thing that I probably find the hardest thing to switch between.
Okay. Yeah, that's
I don't know if that answered your question at all.
No, it does. I'm literally just reflecting on what you've said, and sorry for not bringing up the school as well, because it's really important that we
know.
So when you went back to the club where you began this year, obviously you've taken on a role, bit of a player coach there. Did you get people in the room to sort of define where they wanted the club to go? Did you get players sort of telling you where they would like it to go? And then how did you put that into this sort of the future? How did that work? I literally don't know what you're going to answer here, so I just thought I'd ask.
I think obviously I had a pretty strong affinity to the club.
Yeah.
Having played there as a youngster, and a lot of people had given up an awful lot of time to help me out there, and I'd had really good experience, and I hadn't been there for about 10 years. At that stage, so it was really nice to go back, and I found that it was just a very different place than it was when I was a youngster.
Yeah.
So I had to really consider what my perceptions of that club were like when I was a youngster, and why I enjoyed it so much, and why I was so thankful for it giving me such great opportunities. Understand that the present day is very different, and understand that the people are very different. And then realise that they were also trying to go on a journey as well. So there was three things I had to really think about: was the past, the present, and then the future. And because, you know, they're really trying hard to develop their youth pathway and put things in place. So it was important I didn't come in and totally change everything and try and do something brand new. And it was really important that the people that were there, and this is something I find really odd in football, and I understand why it happens, that like a championship club gets promoted, and then the guys that got that team promoted very seldom get the opportunity to then go and play in the Premier League. And I was trying, I really thought of this analogy in my own head of, okay, the guys that are here need to be the guys that drive this forward. So the first thing I did was just speak to individuals who I knew, and kind of got their perception, and just let them get off their chest what they didn't like. What I found is that no one ever tells you positive things.
No.
When you have these conversations.
Yeah, I would
always
say
it'd be negative.
Very
negative. And then once we've done that, kind of put together a draft idea of what we're going to do, and stole Russell's Earnshaw's quote of kind of looking to play the game of the future, because we didn't really know what that looked like yet. And we tried to frame a lot of stuff under that, thinking a bit more creatively. They were a team who'd only ever played man-to-man. So we've just decided, or I decided, we're just going to play a zone. And they've only ever played 4-3-3. So we've dabbled with all sorts. We played 3-2-3-2. We played 4-3-3. We played 3-4-3. We've just done everything a bit different. And I think the big selling point for me was to say to them, right, I really want to challenge the way you think about the game, and develop the way you think about the game. So it's been a pretty interesting year, because you look back on days that things have gone well, and you think, oh, this has worked really well. And then you look back on days that have gone badly, and then you see people falling back into probably doing the same things that at the start of the year they said they didn't like. So it's going to take a long time, but
I quite like that because you're making comfortable people uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable,
and that uncomfortable ness that comes in is probably what's going to help them learn more about themselves, probably bring togetherness within a team as well, because they're having that. It's not now, it's not natural. Now, the 4-3-3 was probably so natural for a lot of people that actually they were going, well, he's going to go. This is now really making them think and actually making sure that they're concentrating for X amount of time, which is, I do like that.
Well, I think it's like your job as a coach is to ensure psychological safety, but also make sure you provide the optimal level of challenge. Yeah. Things should never be too easy. And fun enough, here at school in our planning stuff, we talk a lot about the success failure ratio. Mm-hmm. And how we kind of try to build up to tougher weeks by manipulating that success and failure. And the kids hate it, but they understand why. And I think that's the other thing. You're never going to be everyone's favourite as a coach. Mm-mm. But it's it's just been interesting to see how it develops. And for me, this job at the club has been really useful for my PhD I've started to do. So I'm really intrigued by how principles of play kind of impact the coordination amongst team members.
Right.
Conscious not to give too much away or someone else will steal my idea and write it before I do. But I'm really intrigued as to how can we simplify our plan and simplify the way we want to play into some really simple principles. You know, I think back to the GB hockey stuff, you know, the best option to go forward and score.
Yeah.
And then stop the teams go forward by denying space. Yeah. I've kind of tried to think about it differently to that, but I'm really intrigued to see how can we use a principle, even if you use the phrase go forward, is that impacting how not only the person on the ball acts, mm-hmm. but how is that impacting the support options? Are we starting to get a sense of people not thinking alike, because you don't want them to be robotic, but people mm-hmm. starting to understand what everyone is seeing. So if we're both on the pitch and you've got the ball, you know, you're under pressure, but I can then work out, okay, our principles go forward. And what can everyone else do? So I'm just really, I think it's definitely a really cool way to coach, because it throws the decision making back in the hands of the learner.
Yeah, it definitely does. Yeah.
Which for me, and then it's also how you as a coach can still control in a way where you're going and the vision, and make sure that you can then achieve the vision, because the principles that you let your players create obviously will be facilitated by you, but that can then determine your long-term goal of how you're going to get there, and also then operationalize how you coach. And I think that's made life really easy for us from a session, kind of a session by session situation, because we'll just look at a principle and our whole session will be based around that. And we'll talk about different scenarios where that might exist, or how does that work in this part of the pitch and this part of the pitch, or when we're down a man or when we're up a man. So that's been really cool, and I've just been able to throw some different stuff down, and the players were very keen for that. Some of them have been awful ideas,
right?
And some of them have worked a lot better. But you know, I think that's the thing for me, doing that PhD study was about kind of making myself better and learning a bit more about how to coach and the why I would do certain things. So it's been really interesting.
That's good. I mean, I hope that all works out, and that it'd be a great read, I'm sure, by the time that you finished it. So it'd be interesting to see where that goes.
I don't think I'll ever finish it at this rate.
No, with the amount of time that you're having to spend coaching and whatever else. But hey, look, you will. You're a good self-organizer. You've found a way to be able to make the right decisions. So educationally and coaching wise, so I'm sure it's going to happen. I'm sure it will. So just finally, what does the future then look like for you? Where do you see yourself going? What's it look like for your job roles that you're in? So what are you trying to do next?
I suppose mission one is to not get sacked from any of them. if you'd asked me 5 years ago what life would look like now, I wouldn't have been able to paint you this picture of where I currently sit. And I'm very thankful, very humble for the opportunities I've given, but also realise that who knows what 5 years' time is going to look like again. I would love to take my coaching to a level where, you know, I'm not just an assistant to a national team, that maybe I can get to a stage where I would be able to be a head coach. I think that'd be brilliant. But also safe in the knowledge that at some point you're going to fail in sport. And sport is this cutthroat world that when you fail, you have to find something else to do. And I think that's where my drive to kind of keep doing the academic side will hopefully lead to something after I eventually don't succeed. And that's, I know that to some people that sounds like a really negative thought process, but I'm just really thinking about contingency planning. So would love to kind of keep going with that. The nice thing for me just now is I get to work with so many different groups of learners and individuals.
It is such a wide range. Looking at it, what you've got there is such a wide range, which is, you know, credit.
Which is brilliant. Which is brilliant because I'm getting to work with people who are at the elite end of the international scale. I'm also getting to work, I mean, this afternoon I go and take my primary fours, so my 8-year-old kids, who are really just at their introduction to the game, which is obviously like it's complete opposite ends of that spectrum. So I would love to keep doing that. I think it just depends how time goes. And I think this is the other thing is that I see people like an Arsene Wenger, who I really admire as a guy who hung around for so long and did such a good job. I'm not sure I'd be able to be at the stage where I could be in one role for that long. And I wonder if a lot of people are the same in coaching, because it gets to a stage where your ideas aren't fresh anymore. You can't keep reinventing the wheel and you can't keep coming up with new stuff. So in an answer to your question, I would love to kind of go and coach at the top level in an international setting. That would be my dream in terms of coaching. Where I will end up, I really don't know. But I'm so lucky that I have all these roles that I genuinely enjoy doing and I genuinely love doing. So,
absolutely. And, you know, just listening to your journey throughout that there, it's, you know, it's amazing. And how you can do all the stuff that you're doing at the moment, you know, as you've just mentioned, they're going to coach the under-8s later on. And, yeah, at some point in the next X amount of weeks, you'll be going back with the senior women. Again, then you're going to be with your under-16s as the head coach. Plus, you've got your stuff at the club, which is a mixture of adults and juniors. You know, the planning, the way that you have to adapt your coaching style to do all of that is, you know, is unreal. But I can imagine that's probably what makes you such a good adaptable coach, is that you're having to cope with all different environments in your daily life.
I don't know. And actually, I say to people, I really enjoy it. It's nice because I never feel like anything ever gets stale in one environment, because before you know it, you're flipping off to something else. I think it's this summer is going to be really interesting. And, you know, how long I'll be able to go on doing an under-16 boys program as a head coach and a senior program as an assistant, I don't know. Because it's an awful lot of time. And I'm just looking at my calendar, which sits in front of me. So then, like, in April, I go from being in Holland with the women for 3 matches against the USA, and then fly straight into Cardiff with the under-16. So who knows? But I think it's really forced me to think about planning. And I think that's there's an opportunity to learn in everything. Absolutely. You know, and I think the opportunity with the women, which I did not foresee and didn't ever see coming my way, has been a really nice impetus, because it's made me think about how I can then kind of take, not a backward step from the under-16s program, but how I can run it differently, how I can let my assistant coaches take a bit more responsibility, how I can try and kind of get myself better as a coach. I've always been intrigued watching people who, head coaches who coach from the stand, and I've just never had the bravery to try it. So things like that, I'm going to try that in the under-16 setup, which is obviously a situation where I can, and take myself away. And I think I'm going to hate it. I think I'm going to hate every single second not being on the bench, because there's the kind of amazing thrill, as you'll know, of being on the side of a pitch.
There is. Yeah.
So, but it's made me reflect and think. Yeah, absolutely. So the first thing is to get myself off the bench and let one of my assistant coaches go on the bench and give him a chance to develop, and see then what impact I can have at halftime or at quarter time, or how it will change the players' ability. And I find a lot under 16 level that they come off and they always want feedback straight away. Was that good? Was that good? Was that good? And my constant question is, well, do you think it was good? Now, me being off the bench and I'm even going to try and move around a bit, so I can't really be seen. It will be interesting to see how that changes. How does my view change of the game? Yeah. And how does that then kind of impact the feedback that I can give or the questions that I can ask? Mm-hmm. And then also, how can I suppose at that level, because you're new to all, we had a lot of conversations about how we can use the radios better. And mm-hmm. that's something that, you know, not everyone knows about when they first do it. Mm-hmm. I'll be interested to see, you know, what kind of information can I pass back to the bench when I'm not on the bench that can kind of be acted on. And I think that's you asked a question earlier about how do you kind of jump between the different environments, and that's the big learning for me has been, well, actually, if I can really inspire and empower my assistant coaches to have more of a role and more of a responsibility, then that makes my job easier to jump between these different environments. And it's been really tough. It's been tough as a youngster. I'm still calling myself a youngster, even though I'm 28. I'm going to hang on to that for as long as I can. as a youngster in, the coaching world, it's been strange having assistant coaches who are at times kind of 10 or 15 years older than me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's been an odd thing to get over. And that was a battle I had when I first started at the school. That people are saying, hang on, I've been at this for 15 years. Why is this young whippersnapper telling me I need to do things differently or having conversations with me? So, and that's also been a brilliant bit of learning for me about how to communicate. So I'm really looking forward to the summer. I'm not quite sure how much sleep I'm going to have. But it'll be really cool just to jump between the two. And I think for me, it's changed from, you know, can we win the games with the under 16 stack? How much are these kids going to learn? And can we set them on a journey that's going to help them become under 18 internationals, then under 21s, and then are they going to be the next generation of Scots that have real success? And are they going to be the guys in 10 years' time that are preparing for the European A division not the guys now? So
I'd be intrigued to find out how your assistant coaches adapt, and what are they like when you're not on the bench? Do you know, do they adopt the same style? You know, do they allow the children to sort of make those decisions? Are they inputting more? Do they feel like they have to step up? You know, do they feel like, oh, I'm here now and I'm in charge of this bench? You know, what does that do for them? Because they've probably not been exposed to that. So what's actually happening there? So I think that's a really cool thing for you to try and do. And it'd be good to chat again after it's finished and find out how all of that sort of went and what challenges you came across and how did you make it a success or was it a flop and what did you do to sort of move on? Because it doesn't matter, does it? You know, at the end of the day, as long as everybody's learning, then and if you learn something from that and there are errors and there are things that are made, it's just interesting to find out how you've developed, because I make just as many errors, if not more now, than I've ever made in my life. But it's actually about what do we do differently next time and how does that look? And,
you know. And I think it's also really refreshing to admit that to people. Yeah. You know, I find myself constantly, if I've come up with something new or a new game or a new exercise, and kids ask, well, how does it work? What's the rotation here? And I'm like, I really don't know. I've just made this up. This might totally flop. Let's just try and work it out. Let's try and work it out together to make it work. And I think the second that, you know, a lot of people say, oh, but by the time you've been, so my school rule, by the time you've been here for 5 years, you've surely got a routine. And it's like, well, yeah, there's a routine, yes, but if you just keep doing the same thing, you're always going to get the same outcome. So it's about thinking, right, well, that worked. Okay, could we do that better? Or that didn't work, you know, how can we adapt that? Yeah, so
for sure.
This... 5 years ago, I would not have been doing this. I would have still been stood on the sideline shouting at players, telling them where to pass if we hadn't lost that game 5-0. So
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And just interestingly on that, just give you a little bit of a story about what we did the other week. So with the regional stuff here, head coach of the boys at Yorkshire, we went up to Durham. And Sarah Bertram's a really good friend of mine. She coaches the Durham boys up there. The under 15 boys, we did some training together. We mixed it up, coaches co-coached together, and we did loads of different stuff. The boys all mixed up. In the afternoon, we played a little bit. We played sort of 15-minute quarters, but wasn't traditional, so it wasn't about the result or anything like that. We were working on some development stuff. So first quarter was, I think my boys were working on... applying pressure. So they were working, they came up with a way that they wanted to basically press the ball. And okay, so that was completely up to them how they did that. And Sarah's boys were looking to get the ball under pressure, and how did they make those effective decisions. So it was really interesting about the different systems that we played and let them sort of do that. The second period, we actually threw in to my boys that, right, they're going to play the same way now. So they're going to press really high up still. They're going to be looking for this fast attack, this fast break. So they're going to soak it up, then they're going to attack hard. So how are you going to adapt to it? How are you going to change? They had this little chat, but actually what had happened was Sarah was going to, her team had decided they were going to half court press, and we knew that that's what they were going to do. Like, me and Sarah knew that that's what her boys wanted to do. They wanted to apply a zonal pressure, but only in a half court situation. So, but her boys thought that my team were going to carry on doing what they're doing. So we sort of had this chat and then we let it happen. So for 4 minutes of the game, both teams are sort of not knowing what's going on, because this is not what's been said. This is not how it's supposed to be happening. So what happens here? So because it's just a training day for us, we just sort of blew the whistle, brought them all in, and was like, what's happening? And it was really interesting. They could both tell you what was going on, but yet nobody was doing anything about it. And they were expecting us as coaches to change that. And I was like, but surely if you can see that, why doesn't someone take the lead? You know, we've got these people here that are, you know, you're thinking about the end in mind, you're self-organizing, you make the right decision. Would you, if that's this team were doing that now, would you still play it the same way? It was just really interesting to do that. But, you know, parents came up and said, why did you do that? Why? And I said, well, it was just a learning experience. Well, what were you expecting to get from it? I don't know. I didn't know how these boys would react. So I just wanted to know how boys reacted, and Sarah wanted to know how her boys reacted to different situations and scenarios. So,
but I also think, you know, this is like such a brilliant example of not just developing the hockey aspect, but also teaching the players about how to learn.
Yeah.
You know, so there's this notion of, and I really think there's a space in the coach's toolbox for this approach that kind of hones these metacognitive skills of players and like develops this deep understanding. And I've been reading a lot recently into this notion of knowledge of gameplay and knowledge of how to act in games, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that's the different thing you've kind of coupled on there is, you know, they know what's going on. You know, they can see it, but then they really, do they now have that deep understanding of how they should then act in that scenario? And you only know that if you're put in that. And the only time you learn about how to do that is from actually being thrown in that situation. So, and these are things that are applied to stuff on Twitter all the time about parents. Parents are tough. Parents want the best for their kids.
They do.
You know? And it's a coach. You could probably look back on some coach education and feel that it didn't really prepare you for what coaching life is really like.
No.
And I wonder if then parent education doesn't really prepare them for what life is really like. And it's the same thing. So have you seen any changes in their behaviours after that session, or have you not had another session since?
We've had one session since, and the behaviour change was, to be fair, the behaviour change was more on the day. In the training, we sort of reflected on that and then went back in, and that's going to adapt more. But it was more the behaviour change on the day, but it was more behaviour change from the parents as well. Because it kind of, we were doing some tasks with parents as well on the sideline, which I'm quite open to admitting that for me, it's just trial and error. But that behaviour change was evident that they realized this wasn't a competitive game, and they're no longer, they don't know what's going on. They didn't know. So if they don't know, they can't shout. They're also trying to focus on all sorts of stuff because I've given them clickers and I'm irritating them. So that was them. But literally the kids on the bench with the kids that are going, we need to watch this more because we can see this and maybe we can help. So then when we go on, I'm going, yes. That's exactly what it was. So when they were on the bench previously, they probably were chatting, and I've tried to sort of say to them, maybe you should be watching. That was evident for them. That was their visual learners going, right, actually, we could have probably helped him. We could have helped some teammates. Yep, you could. You're right. You're definite. So Yeah, it's cool. I'm really excited to see where this goes next because yeah, it's definitely not going to stop there. I'm definitely going to mess with other bits when we go to different games, and I know that not everyone agrees with it, but for me, it's definitely something that I'm quite keen to do. So
I also think the cool thing about coaching is that it's ever changing.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as new research comes out, it usually is throwing another question into the air.
Yeah.
And I think that's the best thing. And in 5 years' time, who knows? You ask the question of what will I be doing in 5 years' time? In 5 years' time, who knows what coaching is going to look like? Well, who's going to know what people have researched and found? Who knows what it's going to look like in 6 months' time? Because, you know, I read a really good piece the other day and then gave something a try on kind of like a video games approach, digital video games approach. Mm-hmm. And this idea of letting people go up levels based on success and, you know, it's just a really different way of thinking about the game. And I think the best thing that people can do is give stuff a try, you know, never say no to an idea until you've given it a try and see if it works for your group.
Absolutely. And don't just do it the once. That for me is a big thing, you know, through the coach development stuff that I go out there, don't just try it the once and go, nah, it didn't work. Like you've got to give something a go two or three times. You've got to see it in different environments at different stages to figure out whether that works. The video game stuff's really cool. Rusty has shared some stuff about some other hockey coaches that have done stuff. So I know that Elliot Tavarica has done some video game stuff. Sarah herself, she did like a battleships game for attacking into the circle. So obviously, if you find the right zone, it kind of blew up the opposition's battleship one station and stuff like that. It was really great to understand how these sort of games move on. From my point of view, I've just been creating with a couple of other people at England Hockey, we've just been creating a new 5 to 8 year olds program that's all about levels, and I had to really go and have a look at different computer games, a little bit of Super Mario Kart, which took me back to my childhood, just to figure out how we could get through different levels and stuff like that. It's great.
That sounds like some awful market research you had to do there, playing a bit of Mario Kart.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, absolutely. So, look, this has been great. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but we'll definitely do another podcast, and I really want to find out how stuff went on in the summer and some of that. So if it's okay with you, we'll definitely keep in touch and come back and review it. It'd be great to hear how things went.
No, absolutely, Gary. It's been really good fun to chat. So
just want to share with people. You've mentioned Twitter there, how people can get hold of you through social media.
Oh, I've never done this before. Twitter at ChrisDuncan91, at ChrisDuncan91. I'd love to hear from anyone. Happy to chat about anything and share ideas.
Brilliant, brilliant. Look, good luck with everything, all the coaching challenges you got there, your PhD, and good luck with keeping the wife happy, because she sounds like she's in a similar situation to my wife where we barely see each other. So, yeah, good luck with it all.
No, thank you very much, Gary.
No worries. Thank you.